On April the 17th, 1984, another London police constable became a victim of terrorism. PC Yvonne Fletcher was shot dead by a gunman firing from the Libyan embassy in St. James's Square. She was keeping the peace during a demonstration against Colonel Gaddafi. Antonia Higgs covered yet another armed siege on the streets of London.
Just after 10 o'clock this morning, around 70 anti-Gaddafi protesters were shouting slogans outside the building in St. James's Square. There was a sudden, short burst of automatic gunfire from inside. Twelve people fell to the ground as police who'd been marshalling the demonstration tried to get the protesters out of range. There was mass panic.
All Libyan diplomatic staff in London and anyone else currently in the Libyan People's Bureau in St. James's Square will now be required to leave the country. They can do so if they wish at any time, but they are required to do so within 7 days. The police will satisfy themselves that anyone emerging from the Bureau is not carrying arms and explosives with them when they leave the premises, and then that the premises are safe and secure.
The heavy black door of the embassy opens, and 10 days exactly after this siege began, the first Libyans appear. They walk in single file behind the intermediary who's been here since the siege began, over to the west of the square and out of our line of sight. The rest remain inside. The procedure will no doubt be repeated until all the Libyans are out of the embassy. For the police who've had this building under constant surveillance, this must be the most tense moment of all. The Libyans have been led away. We know that they will be checked to see that they have no arms or explosives. Their identities will be checked up on too, but all will be leaving the country. There is no doubt of that.
And indeed, it all did go very much according to plan. 30 Libyans left in all. One of them, the police believe, was the killer of WPC Yvonne Fletcher. But during the whole operation, none showed any emotion.
But Britain wasn't the only country in the world to suffer from terrorism. India's Prime Minister, Indira Gandhi, was assassinated by two of her Sikh bodyguards. Her 40-year-old son, Rajiv, was sworn in as the new Prime Minister. He, too, was to become a victim of terrorism later. 1,000 people were killed in the communal violence that followed Mrs. Gandhi's death. Reporter Dave Loyne travelled to India to cover these momentous events.
She was mother not only to me, but to the whole nation. She served the Indian people to the last drop of her blood. We can and must face this tragic ordeal with fortitude, courage and wisdom. We should remain calm and exercise the maximum restraint. Nothing would hurt the soul of our beloved Indira Gandhi more than the occurrence of violence in any part of our country.
There were two waves of violence in the capital. After the shooting of Indira Gandhi, mobs came over from the wide Jumura River to the east of Delhi, led by militant Hindu agitators. They killed Sikhs and burnt and ransacked their property. The police were heavily outnumbered and stood back. Some police told the mob they wouldn't stop them, providing they killed only Sikhs. The looters then returned home and began to kill people in neighboring settlements, witnesses to the mob violence. Now these poor areas of clay and straw huts with some streets of tiny brick houses are devastated. I've seen a dog chewing at a man's leg and thigh bone lying in the street. There are thousands of poor Hindu and Muslim refugees among the 20,000 Sikhs in camps around Delhi, creating urgent medical and food problems for a city of 7 million, which is just beginning to come to life again. A gun salute and the last post sounded out, echoes of British influence in India. The crowd heard the 23rd Psalm and prayers by Mother Teresa of Calcutta, as well as a series of Hindu chants, before Rajiv Gandhi walked in a series of circles around the body of his mother, dropping flames that burn a ring of fire. The pile of sandalwood covered with sandalwood dust mixed with scent and oil lit quickly. The body of the woman who led India for 15 of the last 18 years is burnt. The smoke going to join the smoke of the countless other fires that have set alight to Delhi since her bloody assassination on Wednesday. Dave Loyne, IRN, Delhi.
A long and bitter miners' strike resulted in more public disorder and the largest and most controversial police operation in this country's history. Thousands of officers from forces all over the United Kingdom were bussed into mining communities to prevent any form of large-scale picketing. miners' leader Arthur Scargill agreed to take part in a live interview for Independent Radio News with journalist Chris Mann.
Welcome to the Independent Radio Network. Good afternoon, Mr. Scargill. 5 weeks into this dispute, the membership of the National Union of Mine Workers is still divided on whether to follow your call for a national strike over pit closures. Would you concede that the divide is a bitter one and that, like never before, miner is pitched against miner?
Well, let me first of all correct you. The miners are not divided about the call that Arthur Scargill or the National Executive Committee have made. The National Executive Committee have given authorization and declared official for those strikes that are already taking place in various areas of the National Union of Mine Workers. And so there's no dispute about the fight against pit closures.
Well, Nottinghamshire miners would disagree with you.
Well, I'm sorry, but you must get your facts straight. The National Executive Committee have declared official any area strike that takes place. And that does not say that the National Executive at this stage have done anything other than that. What we would point out is this, that the dispute currently in the British coalfield is the responsibility of the National Coal Board and the Conservative government. It was their announcement to cut out capacity in this industry and close over 20 pits with the loss of 20,000 jobs
that
sparked
off.
At
this point, Mr. Scargill, you cannot speak as representative of all areas, can you? Nottinghamshire men have said they don't want to join your rolling strike.
Well, this is the third time now that you've talked about my role in strike or my decision. Now, I'm not going to correct you again, I hope. I'm telling you again what the position of the National Executive is. And if people misinterpret what we're doing in the way that you're doing, then clearly it's little wonder the British public don't know the facts. Mr. McGregor...
We'll come to those in a minute. Mr. Ray Chadburn, the Nottinghamshire President,
I'm sorry,
speaking just last
you can
week,
either listen to the answers that I'm giving, or alternatively, you can shut up.
We'll,
it's entirely
we'll
up to you.
We'll come to those figures later, Mr.
No,
Scargill.
I'm
I'll
sorry.
Guarantee you that. But at
well,
the beginning, can
one
we
thing
talk
that you're going to learn on an interview of this kind is
union.
That you're going to listen clearly to the things that I
Mr.
want to
Chadburn,
talk about.
Mr. Chadburn, the Nottinghamshire President, has spoken how the dispute has forced miner against miner, father against son, pit against pit. He has 30 years in the industry. Is he wrong, then?
Mr. McGregor made an announcement that there was going to be capacity taken out of this industry. And he suggested that there was 4 million tonnes. That is clearly
Mr.
untrue.
Mr. we will deal with those points later in the
now,
interview.
Now, are you going to listen?
No.
Well,
at the moment,
then,
can
as far as I'm concerned, you might as well pack up this interview.
Can you answer my questions
now,
at the
it's
moment.
Obvious that you're not going
to
listen.
We will come to those points later.
And if you're not going to listen, lad, then there's no point in me talking to
Mr.
you,
Mr. Scargill, only last weekend you personally attended a rally where there was physical fighting between moderate and militant miners. That seems like a bitter divide in your union.
Mr. McGregor declared there was going to be capacity taken out of this industry with the closure of over 20 pits and over 20,000 men going to be sacked. That sparked off this current dispute. Mr. McGregor did not tell the public, or the miners in fact, that the real cause of the dispute was the taking out of capacity over 8 million tonnes. That's double the capacity that he suggested to the miners' union.
Now, these arguments have been covered before in the dispute, Mr. Scargill. No. We've reached a point now where you've reached a crossroads for your union. Mr. McGregor says he won't back down one whit on his closure plan, and he says that it's a fight to the finish. Would you agree with that at this stage?
Mr. McGregor has started this dispute as a result of his determination to close pits and to sack miners. 20,000 jobs, he said, are going to go in this coming year, and over 20 pits are going to be closed. This is an industry which produces the cheapest deep mine coal in the world. In the United States of America last year, they already had produced not only coal reserves, but at a rate where they had over $2,000 million in aid. In Western Germany, they had £2,394 million in subsidies. If we have the same subsidy level, every single tonne of coal that we produce could be sold. The only reason we can't sell coal in Britain is because this industry is being disadvantaged by the policy of this government and, of course, of the Coal Board, who are not telling the truth either to the miners' union or to the British people.
OK, Mr. Scargill, you've made your point. You and Mr. McGregor differ on those facts. Let's look at the damage that's being done to your industry by this very dispute. It might be, say, October before you got what surely you ultimately want, which is a capitulation by the Coal Board, perhaps even a new government, a Coal Board chief more to your liking. Mr. McGregor says he can hold out for up to October. He also says the damage done both financially to the order books and geologically to the condition underground to many pits would mean that more would have to be closed because of the dispute and more jobs lost than would happen in his current closure plan. How do you answer that?
Well, first of all, I would answer by saying that it appears that you're speaking as a representative either of the National Coal Board or the Tory government. The slanted way
I'm
in which you're presented. Now, look, are you going to listen to my answers?
Well,
and if you're not,
kindly don't
then
make
you
accusations.
Look,
like that,
well,
Scargill.
I'm making accusations.
I'm making
accusations against you for the simple reason that what you're trying to do is try to conduct this interview and probably make yourself a budding Robin Day. Well, they're not doing it with me, lad.
I asked you a point, put you a point that Mr. McGregor made at the weekend, that he says he can hold out till October. what sort of damage will be done to the industry? Now, sure, this is a matter of great importance to the British public. They are due an explanation, or your response to that point.
What the position in this industry at the present time is that we produce the cheapest deep mine coal in the world. Mr. McGregor has seen fit to announce a closure program. A closure program that will mean the loss of over 20,000 jobs. Men and women in this industry who invested their very lives in it. Now, I'm not prepared to sit here and listen to comments like you're making when that's the future,
that's
or lack of future, that's being put to those people that I represent.
It's not a comment from me, it's a point
There's
of
no
view
doubt, as far as I'm concerned,
why won't you
that this
to it?
Industry can sell every ton of coal that it produces, provided we're given a chance. And if we were given the same level of subsidies that apply in the rest of the world, we could sell every single ton of coal that we produce.
Can you please answer the question?
Now, are you going to listen to my answers or not?
If you listen to my questions and give answers to them,
look,
it's as simple as that.
Quite frankly, either you're going to listen to my answers or you're not. And if you're not, then you're going to obviously make yourself look a complete
to the
fool.
I'm putting, Mr. Scargill.
You're either going to let me answer.
One answer.
You're either going to let me answer the questions in my way, or if you want, write the answers that you want on a board and tell people that you want me to answer those questions your way.
Can you come to the point then and answer the question?
I can come to any point I want, provided you'll shut up and let me answer. Now, if you won't shut up, then
I can't.
I'm
putting the questions to you, Mr. Scargill.
Now, are you going to let me answer points in my way without interruption? If you're not, then this interview is going to go on in this silly way as a result of your irresponsible attitude.
Let's move on to something else. The meeting you're having tomorrow.
No, I'm sorry, we're not moving on to anything until you let me put the point of view across that I want to put across on behalf of those that I represent.
I think you've put it over several times,
I'm sorry,
Mr. Scargill.
All I've done so far is be interrupted by an ignorant man like you who ought to have more sense. Now, if you're not going to listen independently and allow me to put my point of view, then I suggest that you ought to get out of that chair and let somebody do the job that can do it.
Well, if you're going to be abusive like that, it's not a surprise that you have the problems that you have in your industry, Mr. Scargill.
Isn't it? Mr. McGregor, of course, refuses to meet me in interview or debate. You conveniently ignored that fact. You conveniently ignore the
Mr.
fact...
Mr. Scargill, can we conduct this interview rather than having a slamming match?
Well, you started it, not me, and you interjected all the way through.
Well, if you wanted to make your point...
When I tried to give you some statistical data about this industry... Well, I mean, all that you're doing so far is to present a question and then conveniently ignore the point that I want to give by way of response.
Let's move on then to another question, Mr. Scargill. Isn't it reasonable to allow some closures of pits and not to say simply, as you do, that we oppose all pit closures?
Well, you see, there again you're completely wrong. The National Union of Mine Workers have only opposed the closure of pits on economic grounds. They've never said that we oppose the closure of pits that are exhausted. To do so would be not only irresponsible, but plain daft. But the Coal Board, in their presentation of the argument, would try to portray that that's the case. What we're saying to you is this, that the National Coal Board are trying to sack over 20,000 of our people and close over 20 pits in an industry which produces the cheapest coal in the world. And that, in my view, is economic insanity. There can be little doubt that we can compete with the best in the world, provided we're given an opportunity. And what we are saying to Mr. McGregor and the Coal Board and the Tory government is to change your policy. We want to see people employed, not unemployed. We don't want to see 20,000 people added to the misery of 4.5 million unemployed. And that's what's at stake as a result of this government and the Coal Board's policy.
Mr. Scargill, why so far in this dispute have you not held a national strike ballot? Wouldn't it be simpler to pull all the membership behind you to end all the arguments? At one stroke you could do that.
What we have done in this dispute so far is respond to Mr. McGregor's decision to close pits and to sack people. And the National Union of Mine Workers have acted throughout the dispute in accordance with the democratic procedures laid down in our constitution and rule book. And if I...
Are you afraid of losing the national ballot?
If IRN...
Are you afraid of losing it? Are you confident of winning it?
Are you going to shut up? If IRN or any other independent organisation that you term as independent had the same democratic structures, you'd have no problems.
It seems you're incapable of answering any questions, Mr. Scott.
It seems as though you're the most ignorant person that I've ever discussed with on radio. Now, either you're going to listen to answers, even though you don't like them, or you're not. It's entirely up to you.
Mr. Scargill, thank you for joining us, and I'm afraid not answering any of our questions here in Sheffield this afternoon. This live interview with the miners' leader, Arthur Scargill,
this live interview has been absolutely appalling.
My name's Chris Mann, Independent Radio News, it's 1:30.
But the policy of Mrs. Thatcher's Conservative government did not go down very well with former Prime Minister Harold Macmillan. As Lord Stockton, he took his seat in the House of Lords and used his maiden speech to speak up for the miners.
It breaks my heart to see. I can't interfere with anything, my age. what is happening in our country today. This terrible strike of the best men in the world who beat the Kaiser's army and beat Hitler's army and never give in. Pointless, endless. But we can't afford that kind of thing.
But with alternative sources of power, the electricity companies had ensured that they had stockpiles of coal. This would not be another three-day week. Nottinghamshire miners also broke away from the NUM to form a rival union, and the coal board claimed the miners were returning to work of their own accord.
This union has mobilised the whole of our union, the magnificent women's support groups, and tremendous sections of the working class in an unprecedented way. We go back on Tuesday. We go back together, and as far as we're concerned, this union fights to retain Pitt's jobs and communities.
The church bells of the last pit in the Rhondda Valley rang out. Then Mardy's 750 miners with their supporters went into work behind a brass band. With some relief, but sadness for men sacked during the dispute.
While there's men around like Mardy, they won't be left out because they'll fight every day for their bloody job.
They've been found not guilty in the bloody courts, and still they've been bloody sacked. Yeah. Well, this is not on.
Is this justice?
No way is it justice.
This strike may not have been won, but these men have agreed to nothing they don't want, and they've gone back to work united.
There's no victor, there's no vanquished. The true sufferer is the coal industry, and it'll be up to us to remove that suffering and get it back to a viable industry as quickly as we can.
In 1985, international terrorism continued to bring misery to people of all nationalities. An Air India Boeing 747 from Canada disappeared into the sea off Ireland, killing 325 people. A TWA airliner was hijacked to Beirut. A young US sailor on board was murdered by the terrorists.
We were informed by Shanwick Air Traffic Control Centre that 747 had disappeared off of secondary radar.
I feel very much grieved, and you know, all my family, to hear this shocking news, bringing down this jumbo jet carrying innocent people, and they are really murdered without any reason. Whoever responsible it, I pray to God that these men or woman or whoever he is should be punished severely.
He has pulled a hand grenade, Ted, and he is ready to blow up the aircraft if he has to. We must land at Beirut. They are beating the passengers. They are beating the passengers. They are threatening to kill them now. We want the fuel now, immediately.
This group of 40 Americans are indeed innocent people. We are not warriors. We are innocent victims, a mixture of persons who were on vacation, people who work, all people who simply are Americans going about their business.
Back home, the first of two appalling soccer disasters. Flames spread through the main stand at Bradford City's ground. The club had been celebrating promotion to the second division. Sports commentator for Pennine Radio, Tony Delahunty, was in the stand as the flames began to flare up. What he said took just 48 seconds. That's how little time many of the spectators had to get out alive.
And we're on fire here at Valley Parade. The whole end of the stand at one side is actually in flames now. I can see the orange of the flames, and they're running out of the ground now from that far end at this moment. And people are running around. They're running around beside us. They're running around all around us, and people are saying, get onto that pitch. People all the time spilling onto the pitch. The game is stopped. Mickey Bullet, York, you can see above me. Oh, what can you say?
The whole stand is on fire, Tony. It's an absolute, and it's spreading quickly. There's going to be problems, Tony.
Let's get all those people out of there. Let's get those people. Just take it. Time. Don't rush. Go down there. Don't rush. Don't push. Watch for the kiddies. People are coming around us. You can hear the heat, the smoke coming everywhere. We are going to have to disconnect very shortly because it really is flaming all the time. We're taking a break. We're getting out of here too.
Among the main political stories of the 1980s, Labour leader Neil Kinnock battled to expel the influence of Militant from the party. Militant's presence was symbolised by the deputy leader of Liverpool Council, Derek Hatton. and there was also the resignation of Cabinet Minister Cecil Parkinson after details of his affair with his secretary Sarah Keyes became known.
If she had accepted his offer of resignation on polling day 83, his family and mine, and I personally, would have been spared a great deal of suffering. There might have been a scandal, there probably would have been some degree of scandal when my daughter was born, but I think the matter would have blown over a long, long time ago. I would have been allowed to live in peace with my daughter, and I think Cecil Parkinson will be back in the government now.
You start with far-fetched resolutions. They are then pickled into a rigid dogma, a code. And you go through the years sticking to that, outdated, misplaced, irrelevant to the real needs, and you end in the grotesque chaos of a Labour council, hiring taxis to scuttle around a city, handing out redundancy notices to its own workers.
We're still not in the business of making cuts and redundancies. A temporary setback maybe here, but that's all we're talking about. We'll go on from strength to strength in Liverpool, despite the national leadership, despite the trade union leadership, and despite the press and the poisoners in the media.
Since the first moon landings in the late 1960s, little progress had been made in the exploration of space. To save money, the United States had developed the reusable space shuttle. In 1986, NASA decided to take ordinary citizens up to space. But the first journey of schoolteacher Christa McAuliffe was to end in a human tragedy that, in the words of President Reagan, touched the face of the world.
Velocity 2,257 feet per second. Altitude 4.3 nautical miles. Downrange distance 3 nautical miles. Engines throttling up. 3 engines now at 104%.
Challenger, go at throttle up.
Challenger, go at throttle up.
The crew of the Space Shuttle Challenger honored us for the manner in which they lived their lives. We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them, this morning, as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of Earth to touch the face of God.
Here at home in 1986, we saw the end of a major political institution. Many people regret its passing. The Greater London Council was a symbol, on the south bank of the Thames facing Parliament, of opposition to Mrs. Thatcher's Conservative government. Labour GLC leader Ken Livingstone had a penchant for hanging banners from County Hall, reminding Londoners of the latest unemployment figures. Reporter Rodney Bennett witnessed the GLC's final seconds of existence.
First chime of midnight, it's April the 1st. The GLC has breathed its last. However, County Hall is still brightly illuminated with floodlighting. And there goes the farewell fireworks display. The GLC flag is being lowered on the mast in front of the riverbank side of County Hall, and more fireworks are coming up from behind the building.
...1987 has been described as a year of civil disasters. LBC's reporters covered these distressing events. In the case of Lindsay Taylor, he found his underground train pulling into King's Cross Station on the night of a fire which killed 31 people.
As our tube train pulled into King's Cross, passengers were ordered not to get off until the next stop.
We apologise to passengers of King's Cross, but there was a fire upstairs, there was no exit from the station.
No one who was there on the evening of Wednesday, the 18th of November, will ever forget.
And she was crying all the time. And my friend, you couldn't touch her because her face and her hand was all smothered in black.
No one who was caught up in those events that night, who was called upon to help, will ever forget.
We were travelling up the escalator, and I could see the reflection of the flames.
No one who, at a distance, saw or heard of the tragedy will ever forget what happened.
Fire number four in front of me now. There's a man lying on the ground. They've connected up some medical equipment to him. And
no praise can be too high for the heroism of the police and fire service who worked amidst such appalling conditions at great personal risk and cost to themselves. No praise can be too high for the response of the ambulance service and the staff of our hospitals and London Transport when this terrible emergency was thrust upon them.
And then I see one fireman collapse.
There seems to be no sign of life.
And most especially, we continue to remember the sacrifice made by Colin Townley, who gave his life to save others.
Well, I think it's a fact that not enough attention or money was paid to safety on the underground in the past, and all that's going to have to change if we're to have a safe, sound, clean, well-run system in the future.
In a small village called Hungerford near Newbury, 27-year-old Michael Ryan dressed himself in combat gear and ran amok with an automatic weapon. 14 people died and 15 were wounded. Independent radio reporters were there to record the impact of this awful massacre.
We stood off at the moment because it's so dangerous, the guy's still on the loose with this rifle. The police are clearing an area at a time, and we're going in and we're literally snatching casualties, and we've taken approximately 10 to hospital, some of them fatally wounded at this moment in time.
How many ambulances do you have standing by?
We have 9 vehicles available at the moment.
Do you understand more people are involved?
We don't know how many more people are involved. There's a lot of police in there. It's too dangerous for the ambulance crews to go in there yet. We have to wait for them releasing an area that is deemed to be safe to literally pick up 1, 2 or 3 patients at a time.
You mentioned you take a number of people to hospital already. Are you aware of their injuries?
Some of them were seriously injured. I can't really say any more at this time. And there were some fatally injured.
We were playing in the garden and we heard lots of bangs and everybody was coming out the doors having a look around. So I went out and had a look and Marie followed me and we saw this man run up in a combat top and well, I looked like Rambo. I saw him and then he sort of stopped and sort of aimed and I froze and then, well, he just smiled and then kept shooting at me. I sort of ran back in and I goes, Mummy, have I been shot? And I don't think she could believe it. And then Fiona came round and they all started putting pressure on my wounds and pads and to stop the bleeding. I don't think I would have survived it without them. I'm glad to be alive. Like other people, they sort of passed away. I think I'm one of the lucky ones.
They were coming down the hill and they said, we're coming to find you. And they just out their hand and held my hand. The little girl, she said, a man in black shot my mummy and he's taken the car keys so we can't drive. So James and me can't drive the car without the car keys. So we're going home.
Sergeant Brightwell, you spent about 90 minutes talking to Ryan in the schoolroom. What sort of things was he saying to you?
Well, he was very concerned about his mother. He kept asking about his mother, how his mother was, and also about a dog, his own dog that he had shot.
Was he fully aware of what he'd done?
Yes, I would say that he was, while I was talking to him, he was calm, rational. He was aware of what he had done. Also, he wanted to know what the casualty figures were in Hungerford, so he was well aware that he had shot a number of people. He kept on, he sort of said, if only the police car hadn't turned up, if only his car had started. He said, I wish I stayed in bed. And he told me that he had a 9mm pistol with him and one round of ammunition. And I sort of asked him, why have you got that one round? And he said, it's obvious. isn't it? So.
And we now come to commit the body and soul of Michael to God's mercy. From all the expert opinions expressed, I fear we shall never know the real reason why he carried out such a ghastly deed. As history records it, it will be just one entry in the vast catalogue of man's inhumanity to man. How sad it all is.
On the 16th of October 1987, I found myself having to broadcast from the LBC radio car parked outside our studios in Gough Square. A great storm had swept across the country, felling trees and power lines and causing death and injury. All the power to LBC's headquarters had been cut off, and I had to read the news by candlelight. Now, coming up, on time, this never fails, the news. It's 9 o'clock. This is Douglas Cameron. At least four people have died after winds gusting at more than 100 miles an hour wrought havoc across southern England. Public transport is ground to a halt, with all train services cancelled on British Rail's southern and eastern regions. The Sea Link ferry Hengist has run aground near Folkestone, and Hampshire have declared a state of civil emergency. In Dorset, two firemen died when a tree fell on their engine as they were dealing with an emergency.
And I'm now flying over Orpington, where there's an absolutely terrifying sight below me. A relatively short road has got about eight large trees which have just crashed across it. One of the trees has come from a front garden. It's been completely uprooted and it's crashed down onto what looks like a red Mini. It's crashed right through the windscreen. And another white car about 20 yards behind. A whole tree has smashed down onto it as well, and that's gone right through the roof. That is an absolutely frightening sight.
Another disaster of 1987 was the capsizing of the Herald of Free Enterprise at Zeebrugge. 192 people died, many of them holidaymakers. The bow doors had been left open, allowing water to pour into the car deck. Linda Duffin spoke to grief-stricken survivors.
Some of the survivors have already flown home. Teresa Gander from Crawley in Sussex is one of the lucky ones. She left on a stretcher, but she is alive. Her boyfriend, Mark Webb, was with her when the boat went down.
Somebody shouted, "We're all going to drown, we're all going to die." And so everyone started screaming and frantically trying to climb up their chairs. And so I forgot all about Teresa, just trying to save myself. And I was sort of swimming around for quite a while. I found that somebody chucked in loads and loads of life rafts and they were weighing people down. But I was near the edge and somebody was pulling on my neck and I was really screaming. I was, you know, worried. I said, "Get off, you're drowning me." And they kept pulling. I said, "Get off, you're drowning me." And I turned around and it was her. She was hanging off me. We didn't even know who was hanging on to who, and I realised it was her.
Sonia Saunders from Raynham in Kent was widowed in the disaster.
And we started moving, and I said, "Oh, it's a bit rough." And with that, the whole side of the boat just tipped up on side, and my husband just slid right down into the water, and he went like a... just hit his head on the bottom of the ceiling, because that was the ceiling, and he just went under. I knew he was dead.
Sonia was saved by a lorry driver who pulled her out of the water along with two little boys. She flew home on a stretcher with multiple fractures, but she says she's just glad she survived the nightmare.
I'm glad to be alive, really. I'm glad I was one of the chosen few to live. Goodness, there's still so many people down there, children, babies. I saw these babies and children all drowning. And this little girl trying to hold her sister up. And her like that, but she was dead. You know, she just went in the water.
Sonia's son, Terry Upton, had to travel to Zeebrugge to identify his stepfather's body.
We just had to walk around, really, and see if he was there, because I didn't know he was there at the time. Just trying to pick him out, which I did.
Had you perhaps hoped till then that he might just still be alive somewhere, or had you given up?
No. One half of me was telling me he was alive and one half was saying, you know, he's dead. But I hadn't given up at that time, no. But
did.
He says it was the worst experience of his life and he's still badly shaken.
Gutted, really. Another word for it. Absolutely gutted.
Terry and his fiancée came close to losing their own lives in the tragedy. They were invited on the trip by his mother.
Because my fiancée was working. Otherwise, we'd have been on the boat as well. Because we'd have gone over with them and we'd have come back on the same boat. So if we'd gone, we might not have been here now.
The memories of the ordeal will live with Terry and his mother forever. For others, the tension and agony continues. Many bodies still haven't been identified. There are at least 100 people in Zeebrugge this morning trying to find out whether their relatives were on the boat, and if they were, whether their bodies have been recovered or are still on board the ship. Some people will have to wait 3 weeks until the boat is salvaged before they know for sure.
The sectarian violence of Northern Ireland has been a constant and ugly feature of LBC's news coverage over the last 20 years. Each outrage throws up a sense of exasperation and frustration, none more so than the bombing of a Remembrance Day parade in Enniskillen, County Fermanagh. Lisa Hampley spent a week in the town and met Gordon Wilson, a grieving father ready to forgive his daughter's killers.
I'm Lisa Hampley. I went to Enniskillen the day the bomb went off, and I stayed with the people there for around a week. I was struck by how the little town had been hit such a harsh blow. Everyone knew a relative, a neighbour, a friend, someone who died, and the community came together in grief. Most days I joined the townspeople at funerals. One day alone, 6 people were buried. When I think of Enniskillen, I think of hundreds of mourners standing under rows of black umbrellas in the driving rain, in dignified silence.
All of a sudden the house was shaken by a massive explosion. My immediate reaction was I rushed out onto the street and the place was just but fog-bound. It was a swirling dust and a death silence, just a silence that... It was an unnatural silence. Immediately, well, 30 seconds later, all the crying started and people were running in distress, shocked, trying to search for relatives, trying to search for a reason, trying to search for reality. Reality just didn't exist here this morning.
Everyone knew someone who died. The simple war memorial, engraved with the words, "Our glorious dead," stands in front of the devastated community centre, which was blown apart. On the memorial are 5 wreaths of poppies splattered with dirt, splintered glass and rubble. To mark the tragedy, pathetic single poppies lie trodden into the ground. The youngest victim and the last to die was nurse 20-year-old Mary Wilson. Her remarkable father, Gordon Wilson, bears no ill will against her killers.
I knew I was hurt a little bit. Mary kept assuring me she was all right. We held each other's hands all the time. In 4 to 6 feet of rubble, we were down. But she found my hand and said, "Dad, is that you?" And I said, "Yes." She kept assuring me she was all right. But in between times, she was screaming. I kept asking her how she was. She assured me she was all right. Holding hands all the while. But in between her replies, she was shouting and screaming with what I took to be pain. And the last time I asked her, she said, "Daddy, I love you very much." Those were her last words. Then somebody came and pulled me out. And I said, "Boys, for God's sake, go back to where you've got me. My daughter's right beside me." Eventually they got her out.
How do you feel about the people who've carried out this outrage? Are you outraged?
I'm sorry for them. I bear them no ill will. I prayed for them last night. Somebody said this morning that it might be the turning point. Let's pray it is. Let's pray it is.
The late 1980s saw the Prince of Wales developing a reputation for outspoken views on architecture and the environment. He expressed his opinions with a sharp wit that helped to win the public's support and affection. At the Mansion House in December 1987, he attacked architects, and in another speech a year later, he saw the funny side of his public image.
"Everywhere I go, it is one of the things people complain about most. And if there is one message,
I would like to deliver this evening, in no uncertain terms, it is that large numbers of us in this country are fed up with being talked down to and dictated to by the existing planning, architectural and development establishment. You have, ladies and gentlemen, to give this much to the Luftwaffe. When it knocked down our buildings, it didn't replace them with anything more offensive than rubble. We did that. Clausewitz called war the continuation of diplomacy by other means. Around St. Paul's, planning turned out to be the continuation of war by other means. Well, what kind of creativity is that? To put up a building which other people have to live with and leave them to live with it while you wander off saying you're tired of it, and then to put up another one which you will presumably get tired of too, leaving yet more people to live with the all too durable consequences of your passing fancy. There is a terrible fecklessness to all this. When grown men can get whole towns in the family way, pay nothing towards maintenance, and call it romance.
Only the other day I was inquiring of an entire bed of old-fashioned roses who were forced to listen to my demented ramblings on the meaning of the universe as I sat cross-legged in the lotus position on the gravel path in front of them. And I was inquiring of them what they thought would happen on my birthday in a Birmingham tramshed.
Two unforgettable disasters of 1988 were the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, killing 259 passengers and 11 residents of the tiny Scottish town, and the Piper Alpha oil rig disaster in the North Sea, which claimed 167 lives. John Alcock and Kevin Murphy reported from Lockerbie. Ben Brown went to Aberdeen to talk to the Piper Alpha survivors.
Altogether, 63 survivors of the disaster were flown here by 10 helicopters. The majority were later discharged, but the two most seriously ill are still here suffering from terrible burns. Others had broken bones from where they leapt into the sea from the blazing rig. Hospital spokesman Alan Reed says the survivors had remarkable tales to tell.
One gentleman told me he jumped something like 200 feet. Another one said he got down somewhere on a ledge about 20 feet above the water, jumped, and within 30 seconds was picked up by an inflatable boat.
One of the problems that faced them was that they could not find an area of sea that was not on fire to jump into. But eventually one did manage to locate an area of sea that they thought they could safely jump into.
The decision was made for me. It was roasting. You know, it was fry or jump, so it was jump.
The experience was thinking you were going to die 100 times, you know. You obviously pray, you know, but you think about your family, you know, your wife and kids, simple as that.
We reported a gas, smell of gas, to the safety department, who came and informed us to vacate the module. Today, done a gas test on it. And about half an hour later, there was a tannoy for the announced to the people who had been working that module that they could now return to work. The gas has got ways and means of shooting along chambers and channels, so the gas can go any place.
The scene here, as dawn breaks over this quiet border town, is one of eerie horror. Some 17 houses stand utterly destroyed by the debris that rained down last night. People here described it as like an earthquake. The roads are torn up, the streets are littered with debris. The houses just stand with their walls, with no roofs, with the people who are there, their bodies still inside. Nobody has yet had time to go looking there. It's a scene of horror. It's a scene that people here have not yet managed in any sense to come to terms with. They say that when the debris started falling, it was as if a fireball was coming out of the sky. They talk of running for their lives, those who survived. What's happened since then is that many people were evacuated. They were taken to a local school for the night. They're slowly being allowed home. Kevin Murphy has been out on the hillsides looking at what remains.
Yes, in fact, I drove up onto the hillsides overlooking the town. On one hilltop is the remains of the nose section of the plane. It's an eerie sight. It's lying on its side in a field 50 yards from some cottages. The cockpit windows are intact, of course, but of course everybody who was inside that cockpit is dead. I've also been clambering up on a small embankment to the main A74 road, which runs past the back of this town. There's twisted bits of metal underfoot. I picked up one piece, for instance. It was only about a foot long, six inches wide, and just a row of rivets. That's all that remains of this one bit of debris, and the debris is that small. It was here that five cars were incinerated. Nearby there's a crater which was blown in the ground. That crater is 30 foot deep. It's impossible really to work out what's plane, what's bits of houses, what's rubbish that's been strewn up by the plane.
The troubles in Northern Ireland involved horrific violence during funerals. A loyalist gunman opened fire on mourners at Milltown Cemetery. Three people were killed, 50 injured. Reporter Mike O'Neill witnessed the atrocity.
All hell is let loose. There's a girl with blood streaming from her face just as the third coffin was being laid into the ground. An explosion went off just behind me. There's another explosion now. They're calling for ambulances by using the press phones. There's also the sound of sniper fire.
The gaffes of President George Bush's vice president election candidate Dan Quayle brought a little light relief to the world of politics.
And I'm pleased and excited to introduce the next vice president of the United States, Senator Dan Quayle.
I have as much experience in the Congress as Jack Kennedy did.
Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
It was an obscene period in our nation's history. No, not our nation's, but in World War II. I mean, we all lived in this century. I didn't live in this century, but in this century's history.
In the Middle East, PLO leader Yasser Arafat sought international credibility by renouncing terrorism. But a revolt against the occupation in Gaza and the West Bank became known as the Intifada. Reporter Peter Alan Frost witnessed a clash between Israelis and Palestinians.
Stones are flying all around me. The Arab refugees here are hurling rocks at these Israeli troops who are running with their gas guns at the ready, some of them with sniper rifles. Behind them follow about 15 troops with assault rifles. That was a tear gas grenade fired at a group of rioters who began throwing stones at the Israeli troops here in the Rafah camp.
That we totally and absolutely renounce all forms of terrorism. We mean our people's right to freedom and national independence, and the right of all parties concerned in the Middle East conflict to exist in peace and security, including the State of Palestine, Israel, and other neighbors.
Drug taking has marred sport for two decades at least. The most notorious case was at the Seoul Olympics, when Ben Johnson won the 100 metres, only to be stripped of his title and sent home to Canada in disgrace.
They're under orders and they're away. And the Olympic city has got off the slow start, but Johnson's flying. It's Johnson. And Johnson's so Johnson from Lewis. Olympic city's going to get a bronze. Ben Johnson, the world champion, has done it. He's upset the Thornbrook. The time, 9.79. And the Canadian, who almost failed to qualify, has won the Olympic gold medal from Carl Lewis. But Linford Christie got a bronze, and he'll be delighted with that.
Urine sample of Ben Johnson, collected on Saturday, 24 September 1988, was found to contain the metabolites of a banned substance, namely stanozolol. Disqualification of this competitor from the games of the 24th Olympiad in Seoul. Of course, the gold medal has been withdrawn by the IOC.
A couple of days ago, Canada had the opportunity of having a day of great national pride. And from that time until today, I guess we're now experiencing a few moments of national embarrassment.
It was a sunny day in April 1989 when Liverpool met Nottingham Forest in the FA Cup semi-final at Hillsborough. Hundreds of fans were fed into the packed West Stand, causing overcrowding. 95 were crushed or suffocated to death. Football correspondent Andrew Gidley was there.
I've seen several fans being given the kiss of life, and advertising hoardings have been used as stretchers to take away injured supporters. But certainly today's FA Cup semi-final can't go on. People have died here at Hillsborough this afternoon watching a football match on a sunny, clear Saturday afternoon in April.
People were just crushing, and were like, there was a lad and his girlfriend, and they were just screaming. These words were, "Please God help me," and I believe the girl died. Her face was just blue.
I was against the bar right at the front, and when I was at the bar at the front, there was people, there was a gentleman on my arm, and he said, you're choking me, and he just fell. Yeah. He just literally fell, and that was the last of him.
It's a cruel hand of fate that disasters often strike when people are enjoying themselves. A riverboat called the Marchioness was crushed and capsized in a collision with a large dredger near Southwark Bridge. 51 people died, many of them young party revellers. Tim Crook reports.
Massive yellow boat came along. It was travelling it really fast. And this, we were parallel with the disco boat, the other disco boat. It was just the same as us, but it was packed with thousands of people. And it came up behind it, right? And it smashed into it, and the other one
went
through.
Standing there, we didn't really think it was going to go over. You know, it started to keel. And then we suddenly realised it was going to go over. So everyone starts scrambling, you know, jumping into the water.
The Marchioness tragedy has become known as the forgotten disaster. But the terror and trauma of that fateful night 2 years ago will not be easily erased for both surviving victims and their relatives.
All the water started coming up and everyone was screaming. People were getting... we was all on, like, bits of the boat, hanging on bits of the boat. Nothing else.
I pushed myself down. I got funneled back up into the same place again. And as I pushed down, I could feel that I was on people. And I think you can see that's got to be where somebody gripped me. Somebody got a vice grip on my arm. And I think he was dead when he let go because we were just suddenly gone.
Mrs. Eileen D'Aglio's 19-year-old daughter, Frances, drowned in the disaster. Outside the Central Criminal Court, Mrs. D'Aglio's tall figure, still dressed in her black mourning clothes, emerged from the public gallery entrance to express her frustration.
I'm overwhelmed, really. I just can't believe that British law allows this to happen. There's something very, very wrong with the law that doesn't allow all the evidence to be examined in a case like this. And for the true things to be put to the jury, for them to consider the true facts and to reach a verdict. It's a waste of public money, and it's yet again, after now nearly 20 months, has left us without a public inquiry, without an inquest, with no right of redress to anybody. Here we are silenced again. And the psychological effect that this is having on all of us is overwhelming. I just can't tell you how we feel. I'm lost for words. We need a royal commission to look into what's wrong with the law that allows what's happened in there to happen today. We need the MPs in Parliament to get up and look at the laws. We elected these damn people into Parliament to represent us and make sure they represent us. They have got to see what's happened to all of us in that court today and bring these people to justice. We only want justice. We don't want anything else. We want justice. That is all we want.
Tim Crook, LBC News Talk 97.3 at the Old Bailey.
A visit by President Gorbachev to China in 1989 sparked off a spontaneous human rights protest. Students filled Tiananmen Square. The Peking government appeared paralyzed for many days, but eventually the tanks rolled in, killing some 2,500 people. Reporter Scott Simme witnessed the massacre, and Australia's Prime Minister Bob Hawke expressed the disgust of the free world.
Gunfire echoed through the Chinese capital as troops pushed their way towards Tiananmen Square. Armored personnel carriers rolled down Chang'an Avenue, the main thoroughfare, with soldiers firing indiscriminately. Around the square, it was a scene of panic. Residents of Beijing who had come to protect the students fled as ricochets whizzed through the crowd. Dead and injured were carried away, some on bicycles, others by ambulance. as the troops prepared to enter the square, which has become a shrine of democracy for many Chinese, only the students remained. At last word, many were directly in front of the firing line, arms linked, defiant to the end. Scott Simme, IRN, Peking.
Anti-personnel carriers and tanks then ran backwards and forwards over the bodies of the slain until they were reduced to pulp, after which bulldozers moved in to push the remains into piles.
The most momentous change in international affairs in 1989 was the coming down of the Iron Curtain. The whole of Eastern Europe appeared to be alight with protest and refugee movements to the west. The communist regime of Erich Honecker in East Germany crumbled, and as Catherine Field and George Matheson reported, so did the Berlin Wall.
Standing here on the western side of the Brandenburg Gate, there are hundreds of people standing on top of the Berlin Wall. There's a man with a pickaxe fighting his way through the concrete. It's flying off in chips. People are jumping around to get bits of it because who knows how much longer the Berlin Wall will last.
The gathered crowd went wild as a mechanical digger began to pull down part of the hated Berlin Wall. 20-year-old Andrea Adler, who's lived all her life beside this part of the wall, was overjoyed.
I see in this moment the wall destroyed, and it's great.
It was another historic and symbolic moment for the East German people, who've seen their country transformed in the space of little over 8 weeks. George Matheson, IRN, East Berlin.
This is Catherine Field standing on top of the Berlin Wall by the Brandenburg Gate. In front of me, I can see the Unter den Linden. It's on the other side of the wall. In between is the no man's land. You can see there's rows and rows of soldiers and police across the Unter den Linden to try and stop the people from East Berlin coming over to West Berlin. But tonight the Berlin Wall has just become a theatre. There's hundreds of people standing on top, and there's thousands more East Berliners who have used tonight for the first time in more than 20 years to come over to West Berlin freely. People are climbing all over the guard towers. People are standing on top of the Berlin Wall. They're laughing and they're crying and they're drinking champagne. You're standing right by the Berlin Wall now, and for the first time in your life, you're going to be able to walk through. How does it feel?
I'm feeling good. I hope that I can go through the wall and go to the other side. They all want to see West Berlin, and they go through the street and see, and they want not to eat and drink, and I think it's what's going.
In 1990, the unthinkable happened. The woman who boasted that she would go on and on and on resigned. She was described in the East as the Iron Lady of the West, adored by very many Americans, including President Ronald Reagan. Margaret Thatcher was Britain's longest-serving Prime Minister since Pitt the Younger. Monetary policy was her downfall. To lose one leading cabinet minister through resignation is unfortunate. But, as Lady Bracknell would say, to lose two is just carelessness. Mrs. Thatcher was defiant to the very end.
And in case anyone doubted it, can I assure you there will be no ducking the bouncers, no stonewalling, no playing for time. The bowling's going to get hit all round the ground. That's my style.
It's rather like sending your opening batsman to the crease, only for them to find, the moment the first balls are bowled, that their bats have been broken before the game by the team captain. The tragedy is, and it is for me personally, for my party, for our whole people, and for my right honourable friend herself, a very real tragedy, that the Prime Minister's perceived attitude towards Europe is running increasingly serious risks for the future of our nation. That conflict of loyalty has become all too great. I no longer believe it possible to resolve that conflict from within this government. That is why I have resigned.
More than 100 of my parliamentary colleagues have urged me to stand and have promised me their support. I am persuaded that I would have a better chance now, a better prospect now, than Mrs. Thatcher, of leading the Conservatives into a fourth electoral victory and thus avoiding the ultimate calamity of a Labour government.
The 8 o'clock news, this is Annie Webster. John Major is the next Prime Minister. He failed by just 2 votes to win the leadership ballot outright, but within minutes his 2 opponents, Michael Heseltine and Douglas Hurd, conceded defeat. It was a sensational development which nobody predicted. Mrs. Thatcher says she's thrilled by Mr. Major's victory, and he says he's honoured.
It's an enormous encouragement to know that so many people in the parliamentary party are prepared to entrust me with the leadership of the Conservative Party, and I will endeavour to discharge those responsibilities to the best of my ability. It is a very exciting thing to become leader of the Conservative Party, and particularly exciting, I think, to follow one of the most remarkable leaders that the Conservative Party has ever had. Our job now, I think, is quite clear. We're going to unite. We're going to unite totally and absolutely, and we're going to win the next general election. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're leaving Downing Street for the last time after 11 and a half wonderful years, and we're very happy that we leave the United Kingdom in a very, very much better state than when we came here 11 and a half years ago. It's been a tremendous privilege to serve this country as Prime Minister. Wonderfully happy years, and I'm immensely grateful to the staff who've supported me so well. Now it's time for a new chapter to open, and I wish John Major all the luck in the world. He'll be splendidly served, and he has the makings of a great Prime Minister, which I'm sure he'll be in very short time. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
He had served one of the longest political sentences this century, and he was the symbol of protest against apartheid. Nelson Mandela was released from prison near Cape Town after 27 years. LBC reporters covered the story in South Africa and also at Wembley Stadium, which had staged special concerts in his name.
I wish to put it plainly that the government has taken a firm decision to release Mr. Mandela unconditionally. He has declared himself to be willing to make a constructive contribution to the peaceful political process in South Africa.
The 3 o'clock news, this is Julie Benson. Nelson Mandela is free. After more than a quarter of a century in jail, he walked hand in hand with his wife Winnie from the gates of Victor Verster Prison near Cape Town in South Africa. IRN's Alison Campbell watched him walk to freedom.
There is absolute pandemonium outside Victor Verster Prison. Nelson Mandela has just walked out of the front gate. He stands in front of us with his fist in the air, and the crowd is going completely crazy. Winnie Mandela is next to him. Bedlam has broken out completely.
I must confess, I'm unable to describe my emotions. I was completely overwhelmed by the enthusiasm. It's something I did not expect.
Our statements and declarations alone will not be sufficient to allay the fears of white South Africans. We must clearly demonstrate our goodwill to our white compatriots and convince them by our conduct and arguments that a South Africa without apartheid will be a better home for all.
Walking on stage to rapturous applause with his wife Winnie, it was almost as if a long-lost son had returned home. For more than 10 minutes, the audience clapped and shouted as he smiled and waved, clearly happy to be in Britain. It was his first visit in almost 3 decades, and it was, he said, his opportunity to thank the British people for continuing to fight apartheid.
Even through the thickness of the prison walls at Robben Island, we heard your voices demanding our freedom.
In 1990, England made it to the semi-final of the World Cup in Italy. Few people had expected manager Bobby Robson to take them that far. Their opponents were West Germany. After extra time at 1-1, it had to be settled by penalties. A place in the final depended on one strike of the ball. Tony Lockwood described what happened.
Now it's Chris Waddle, who simply must score against Bodo Ilgner. It's going to be left foot, steps up, and he's missed, and that is it. Chris Waddle's penalty miss. England are out of the World Cup in the most dramatic fashion possible, and the German players climb all over Bodo Ilgner. It is scenes of celebration for Germany and complete despair for England.
On December the 1st, 1990, history was made with the Channel Tunnel breakthrough. Under the choppy waters of the English Channel, champagne and entente cordiale broke out as Britain and France were joined for the first time since the last ice age. Sue Flipping from Invicta Radio watched the events.
The historic moment came almost 3 years to the day after digging started. A thumb-sized hole appeared in the chalk separating the two countries. Within minutes, it was fist-sized and a hand appeared. More chipping, and almost suddenly it was large enough for the first man, Philippe Cazotte, to be pulled unceremoniously through.
Nice to meet you, Philippe. Are you a driver? Machine driver?
He was greeted by Graham Fagg, one of the longest-serving Channel workers, who'd been chosen by Knott to be the first Briton through to the French side. With that, the floodgates opened, workers and VIPs, including the new Transport Secretary Malcolm Rifkind and Eurotunnel's Chief Executive Alistair Morton, passed from one country to another. 3 hours later, the train carrying the first people to travel from France to Britain through the tunnel returned to the surface. They'd come laden with souvenirs.
A lump full of rock.
Yeah, the French.
Load the rock. That's the actual rock from the actual breakthrough. Yeah. Champagne bottles.
Could you understand each other?
Me? No.
So how did you communicate when you first load food?
We all drink the same.
For the first time, they faced customs and, to commemorate the day, had a special commemorative stamp for their passports. But the day was also one of sadness. 9 men, 7 of them British, have been killed working on the tunnel. Mr. Fagg's daughter, Rita, says she's always feared for her father's safety.
It was a worry. When I lived in Devon, like there'd be an ambulance or something going up that way, or a fire engine or something, you would think to yourself, oh my God, is that the tunnel? But I'm glad it's over in a lot of ways. It's a big relief.
Saddam Hussein's Iraqi regime invaded Kuwait in 1990. By 1991, a massive Allied force had been built up in Saudi Arabia to fight his army and drive it back across the border. Once again, independent radio reporters covered a war involving British forces. Here are the sounds of the Gulf War of 1991.
The 2 o'clock news, this is Howard Hughes. The Gulf War is on. Waves of American and British fighters and bombers have been pounding Baghdad and military targets inside Iraq. The attacks started around midnight our time. They're still going on now.
The liberation of Kuwait has begun. In conjunction with the forces of our coalition partners, the United States has moved under the code name Operation Desert Storm to enforce the mandates of the United Nations Security Council.
It will not, I believe, be a long conflict, but it may be a fierce one. There is no doubt in my mind that it is an absolutely justifiable conflict and that we will win it.
Our strategy to go after this army is very, very simple. First, we're going to cut it off, and then we're going to kill it.
Every field commander in history has had doubts about the outcome of the battle ahead. Do you have any doubts whatsoever that you will win?
Not even one in a million.
I have directed General Norman Schwarzkopf, in conjunction with coalition forces, to use all forces available, including ground forces, to eject the Iraqi army from Kuwait.
Absolutely terrifying. There's no word for it. You're frightened of failure. You're frightened of dying. Oh, it's everything. You're flying as low as you dare, high enough to get the weapons off, but you push it as low as you can over the target just to get away as fast as you can.
30 seconds to drop. I'm going to commit at 15. Okay, happy. And I'm flying manually.
Roger.
On four line is through the target path.
Nothing on the radar. Nothing at all.
Committing.
Switching. Committing in the back.
Late arm. There's a light up there. I don't know who that is. Oh, I know. It's somebody in burner.
Right.
Climbing off
it's
the target.
It's good. Should be going soon. 1 mile to release.
All right. We're getting the odd stuff coming up near us.
Bombs away. Okay, they've gone. Come left, climb.
The 5 o'clock news, this is Howard Hughes. The U.S. military command is admitting that Allied jets deliberately bombed an underground shelter in Baghdad in which the Iraqis claim up to 600 civilians were killed. But the Americans say the target was a military bunker being used as a command center, and they have no idea why civilians were inside.
We now have air superiority, if not air supremacy, and we rule the skies, and it's obviously giving us a great deal of tactical freedom. And so that we're obviously now putting the pressure on and putting the pressure on where it hurts. Today we went in daylight and hit a target accurately with several waves of tornadoes. All who come back with big grins on their face saying they put the bombs right where it hurts.
I heard what I thought were two small explosions, but they were very, very far away. I just got a report from one of my sources here that two missiles have fallen in Tel Aviv. There, a third one is in the air. The civil defense here is telling everyone to put their gas mask on and go into a sealed room. At the moment, I'm ignoring that order. Some people here at the Bureau are putting their gas mask on, and I may do the same very soon.
Saddam has sickened the world with his use of Scud missiles, those inaccurate bombs that indiscriminately strike at cities and innocent civilians in both Israel and Saudi Arabia. These weapons are nothing more than tools of terror, and they do nothing but strengthen our resolve to act against a dictator unmoved by human decency.
The heavy guns poured through border sandbanks deep into enemy territory. They've now dug in, providing the heavy fire support for a charge north by American troops. The one sign of resistance was one trench that had long been deserted. Traveling south, sitting down in the back of four trucks, were tired-looking Iraqi prisoners of war. The joint U.S.-British advance has gone much better than commandos had expected. A key delaying factor now is dealing with the large number of Iraqi units waving the white flag. James Matthews, IRN, in enemy territory.
While our great armed forces will continue its withdrawal from Kuwait and complete it on this day.
As far as Saddam Hussein being a great military strategist, he is neither a strategist, nor is he schooled in the operational art, nor is he a tactician, nor is he a general, nor is he as a soldier. Other than that, he's a great military man. I want you to know that.
The 5 o'clock news, this is James Bayes. The Allies have just stopped firing in the Gulf War. President Bush has been on American television early today to reveal that coalition forces were ceasing hostilities on their side from 5 o'clock this morning our time. But from the Oval Office of the White House, the President stressed the Allied ceasefire is conditional. Mr. Bush reminded his fellow Americans that the ceasefire by the Allies comes exactly 100 hours since the beginning of offensive ground operations and 6 weeks since the start of Operation Desert Storm. And the President reminded the people how the Gulf crisis itself began.
7 months ago, America and the world drew a line in the sand. We declared that the aggression against Kuwait would not stand. And tonight, America and the world have kept their word. This is not a time of euphoria, certainly not a time to gloat, but it is a time of pride. Pride in our troops, pride in the friends who stood with us in the crisis, pride in our nation, and the people whose strength and resolve made victory quick.
The highway was jammed door to door with cars the troops had stolen in a frantic bid to escape. They now lie mangled and burnt out with windscreens shattered by bullet holes. In one, a neatly pressed olive-green uniform lies on the back seat next to a looted video recorder. A Kalashnikov rifle is on the roof where the driver had taken aim for the advancing U.S. Army, his helmet upside down in the sand several feet away. Bodies lie strewn along the road, their number clear evidence of a massacre. James Matthews, IRN, Kuwait.
The civil war in the Lebanon resulted in an evil practice of capturing Western hostages and holding them for ransom. Sometimes nothing would be heard of someone snatched from the streets of Beirut for many years. On other occasions, the hostages would be executed in response to some other event in the Middle East. But gradually, from August 1990 to November 1991, well-known British hostages Brian Keenan, John McCarthy, Jackie Mann and Terry Waite emerged from captivity.
I never allowed myself to think that they were going to shoot me. And if they were, what was the point in thinking about it? I was confident I would get home sometime. I was frightened it would be a long time. I continually told myself and told them that you take only from me my liberty. You don't take my freedom. That you can never take.
It's been a very, very long time. 5 years and 3 months. There are times when it seemed it would never end. You know, one kept hearing news and thought, maybe now, and it would go away. And I think for all of this was a constant strain, a constant pressure on us. And we had to work very hard between us to keep our spirits up, to keep ourselves happy and determined to carry on. Before I was released, I spoke to some leaders of the group that were holding me, which is Islamic Jihad, Jihad Islami. and they said that they believed the time was right now to end all the situation for all the Western hostages. And they've given me a letter that they have asked me to take directly to the Secretary General of the United Nations, Pérez Cuellar.
What is in the letter?
Well, no, I believe that they lay out that they want to make a full exchange of the Western hostages for the all the prisoners, civilian and military, who are currently being held by Israel from Lebanon. That's to include the Lebanese soldiers, civilians, and any Palestinians who have been taken from Lebanon.
Battle of Britain hero Jackie Mann spoke in public a few minutes ago for the first time since being released by his kidnappers. He said his ordeal was extremely harrowing.
My voice has gone after two and a half years of training. Do that, don't do that. Don't speak. Be quiet. That I've lost my voice.
The 9 o'clock news, this is Ian Ramage. Terry Waite has appeared in public for the first time after almost 5 years as a hostage in Beirut. His kidnappers let him go this afternoon. He's been handed over to Britain's ambassador in Syria. Scots-born American Tom Sutherland has also been released. Mr. Waite's just been talking at a news conference in Damascus. He's explained how the kidnappers told him and Sutherland they were being freed.
This afternoon, when we were sitting together in our cell, chained to the wall, as we have been chained to the wall for the last 5 years, and in some cases of Tom and others for 7 years, 23 hours and 50 minutes a day, one of our captors came in and told us that Tom and myself would be freed this evening. He also said to me, "We apologize for having captured you. We recognize that now this was a wrong thing to do. That holding hostages achieves no useful, constructive purpose."
All I can say, though, about the English, they take a hell of a long time to get things done. He came to get me out of there about 5 years ago, and it's taken him 5 years to get me out, but finally he's taking me home. So I'm very, very happy about that. But we're going to have to get some American technology to the Church of England and show them how to get things done a little bit faster.
The 12 o'clock news, this is Howard Hughes. Teddy Anderson, the last American hostage in Lebanon, is finally on his way home. He'd been held for 6 years and 9 months, the longest of any Westerner.
I've thought about this moment for a long time.
These men all gave something to me, helped me. I hope they got something in return. There's Brian Keenan, a really tough Belfast boyo with a penetrating mind. The cliche Irish sense of humor. I mean, he told some of the longest and funniest shaggy dog stories I've heard in a somewhat disreputable life. You saw, all of you, John McCarthy when he came out, looking like he'd just come down from university, smiling and waving. John kept us going a lot with his dignity and his sense of humor. Terry Waite, I mean, what can I say about this man? He risked his life for me. when he lost, when we finally met him in prison, for a year, I never heard him express a word of regret or bitterness, not once. He'd do it again tomorrow. I know it. He's a very brave man, also a man of deep faith.
Mikhail Gorbachev brought about the end of the Cold War. He introduced perestroika and glasnost. He allowed the dissolution of the Iron Curtain, and he gave the countries of Eastern Europe their freedom. But he wasn't able to keep the Soviet Union together. It began to unravel, first in the Baltic states. A clumsy attempt to bring Lithuania into line led to the death of demonstrators in the capital Vilnius, which is where LBC's Moscow correspondent Sue Jameson reports from in her analysis of Russia's second revolution.
Lithuania is a republic in mourning today. 500,000 people turned out for the funerals of 14 killed by the Soviet army at the television tower on the day President Landsbergis was called Sacrifice Sunday. The bodies of 9 of the victims were carried through the streets of Vilnius today in a slow and moving procession from the sports center, where there was a 2-day lying in state, to the cathedral for the official service. The other bodies will be buried in their hometowns. The crowd lined the procession route from first light, all carrying candles, flowers, or wreaths. As the seemingly never-ending procession moved to the cathedral, every face told the story of Saturday night when tanks and troops storming the television tower plowed into a crowd of peaceful demonstrators. In March, Gorbachev launched a nationwide referendum to back his vision of a new union, and though 6 republics boycotted the vote, 75% said yes to the union. But a better example of voters' true feelings came in June, when Boris Yeltsin finally swept to power as Russia's first democratically elected president. A stunning victory, which opened the way to a new relationship between the two former foes, Gorbachev and Yeltsin. News that encouraged the G7 countries meeting in London, and which made Yeltsin a key player when George Bush came to Moscow in June for a superpower summit. Then, just hours before a new union treaty was signed to give republics power at the expense of the Kremlin, President Gorbachev was overthrown by a group of hardliners who sent the tanks into Moscow. Mikhail Gorbachev, on holiday in the Crimea, discovered he was absolutely powerless.
I picked up one of the telephones. It was dead. I picked up the second, third, fourth telephone receivers. All were dead. I was isolated.
And while he waited, Moscow, led by Boris the Brave, rallied to defend the freedoms which perestroika planted 6 years ago. But 3 young men lost their lives as they clashed with tanks near the Russian parliament, which became a symbol of the struggle against those wanting to turn the clocks back. Foiled by the bravery of the people, the refusal of soldiers to kill, and the mismanagement of the Gang of Eight, the coup ended almost as suddenly as it had begun. There's thousands of triumphant people waiting outside the Russian parliament, cheering, chanting, and waving the Russian flag. Heard Boris Yeltsin say,
"Hooray for Russia."
This is a lesson for the country and a lesson for Gorbachev, he said, and warned there was still a vulnerable situation. But he added to cheers, "Reform is now guaranteed because the people fought for their freedoms." And the crowd roared back its approval. Sue Jameson, IRN, Moscow. Then those same people had their first chance to fight back against the institutions which had oppressed them for so long, the Communist Party and the KGB.
There are hundreds of people all around the pedestal where the founder of the KGB, Felix Dzerzhinsky, stood until a few hours ago. Russian deputies are trying to persuade the crowds not to storm the Lubyanka. On loudspeakers, the militia warned there will be bloodshed if people give in to provocation. But for many here, this is a chance at last to show how much they hate the KGB.
And as the year ends, everyone's waiting to see what the new Commonwealth of Independent States will mean for the peoples of the former Soviet Union and for the world.
1990 and 1991 saw a succession of appeal court cases freeing people who had been the victim of major miscarriages of justice. Many had been arrested and charged following IRA atrocities or major public disturbances. Confidence in the criminal justice system was rocked to its foundations. LBC's legal affairs editor Tim Crook reports.
I've been in prison 15 years for something I didn't do, for something I didn't know anything about. Totally innocent man. I watched my father die in a British prison for something he didn't do. He is innocent. The Maguires is innocent. Let's hope the Birmingham 6 is innocent.
We'll be playing you as political scapegoats for people in there at the highest. The police told us from the start that they knew we hadn't done it. They told us they didn't care who done it. They told us that we were selected and that they were going to frame us just to keep the people in there happy. That's what it's all about.
Guildford 4, Birmingham 6, Maguire 7, Tottenham 3, the catchphrases of justice campaigns. These have all left their indelible mark on public confidence in the system of police prosecution, trial by jury, and appeal by judges.
The Birmingham Six are free. They walked from the Old Bailey this afternoon after spending 15 years and 7 months in jail for the murder of 21 people in the 1974 Birmingham pub bombings. Three appeal court judges ruled that all the murder convictions should be quashed because of the fresh evidence introduced about their cases. Tim Crook reports from the Old Bailey.
When Lord Tony Gifford QC asked the judges to express society's deep regret to these men that it's taken 16 years for this injustice to be rectified, relatives clapped loudly. Then Lord Justice Lloyd asked the six men to stand up. He said Richard McElkenny, Patrick Hill, William Powell, John Walker, Robert Gerard Hunter, Hugh Callahan, the reasons for the decision which we are about to announce will be given at a later date. The decision of this court is this, that in the light of the fresh evidence which has become available since the last hearing in this court, your appeals will be allowed. You will be free to go as soon as the usual formalities have been discharged. There then erupted the strongest roar and screaming of delight that the Central Criminal Court is ever likely to hear again.
The quashing of murder convictions with such a fulsome apology. Lord Justice Farquharson expressed profound regret for shortcomings in the criminal process. He said no system of trials is proof against perjury, but this will be a little consolation to its victims. Afterwards, 24-year-old Mark Braithwaite made a passionate speech at a press conference at the London School of Economics. He attacked the prejudice of both the legal system and the media. Sitting beside his mother, he described how the injustice had affected his family.
The Raggett family, they've suffered. I know my father suffered. My sister suffered. My brother suffered. Everybody. It's not a jubilation to me. It's not really... Basically, this ain't... I'm not happy. I'm not overjoyed. I haven't won a raffle. This is my life.
So Mark Braithwaite and Engin Reckitt emerged from the cells at the High Court, having spent 6 years in custody for the convictions, murder convictions, of Police Constable Keith Blakelock. They've been greeted with a round of applause from relatives and supporters. Engin Reckitt is being hugged by his wife Sharon, and people around them are quietening down to give them this very personal moment, embracing each other in a moment of freedom after a period of 6 years. Now, the conviction,
this agonizing concentration of miscarriages of justice has created serious political fallout and heralds a meltdown in judicial arrogance and a belief in the infallibility of the system.
...review of criminal justice processes. He says its aim will be to ensure that cases like the conviction of the Birmingham Six don't happen again.
It is of fundamental importance that the arrangements for criminal justice should secure the speedy conviction of the guilty and the acquittal of the innocent. When that is not achieved, public confidence is undermined.
I'm glad that now we're free, but as we're free, there's still a number of innocent people still in jail, like the Bridgewater Three, Judith Ward, Winston Silcott, Victor Deans, Leroy McCoy, and Tony Quidley, and many, many more who are still there who shouldn't be there.
Justice! I don't think them people in there have got the intelligence nor the honesty to spell the word. Never mind dispense it. They're rotten!
1992 was another general election year. Would Neil Kinnock lead Labour back into Downing Street for the first time since 1979? Would Prime Minister John Major keep the Tories in government? The polls swung one way and then the other, but the poll that mattered ended the political career of Mr. Kinnock as party leader.
Be warned, Mr. Major and Mr. Kinnock, from the lands of conscience and reform, from the ancient bastions of liberalism, the flames are fanning out in all directions, consuming your shabby campaigns, your out-of-date policies, your visionless futures.
And I promise you this, wherever I go between now and April the 9th, this soapbox is coming with me. There's no way they're going to keep the Conservative message from getting right out on the streets, face to face with the people who will make the decision in this election.
Can you give us the name of the girl involved? And can you tell
of course
us why her operation...
Don't be right. silly. You don't think I'm going to give you the name?
Her mother has said this morning that she feels her daughter was used and she objects to the way the Labour Party handled it.
The only way in which Jenny's identity could have been discovered is from some other source.
When I first had the opportunity of standing on the steps of Downing Street, I said that I believed in a nation at ease with itself, the development of a truly classless society with opportunities for all from wherever they came to do whatever they can with their own life, by their own efforts, and with encouragement to achieve everything that they can. That is the sort of society that my colleagues and I will be working hard to build in the next few years.
I naturally feel a strong sense of disappointment. Not for myself, but I feel dismay, sorrow, for so many people in our country who do not share this personal good fortune. They deserve better than they got on the 9th of April 1992.
At the Olympic Games in Barcelona, Linford Christie won the 100 metres, watched by John Anderson.
Away finally in the 100 metres final, and Christie is battling hard, flanked by the two Americans. Christie coming through powerfully. I think Christie's going to do it. It's going to be a gold medal for Linford Christie and Great Britain. He waves his arms in the air, runs towards the crowd. Linford has done it. The time, 9.96. He's beaten the Americans. He's dancing on the track. Linford Christie, the greatest sprinter on earth, the 1992 Olympic champion.
It's the best race of my life. It's the best race I've ran for, you know, the 12 years I've been doing athletics, and I feel pretty good.
Many devalued Christie's medal because Carl Lewis wasn't there. But Christie proved his point a year later when he beat Lewis comprehensively to complete an Olympic and World Championship double in Stuttgart. The Royal House of Windsor had a rough year in 1992. Andrew Morton's book exposed the marriage of the Prince and Princess of Wales to ridicule. The Duke and Duchess of York separated. Windsor Castle was severely damaged by fire, despite the valiant attempts of the Duke of York to help the rescue of antiques and other priceless objects. Even the Queen had to acknowledge that morale wasn't very high at Buckingham Palace, and there was even more bad news just before Christmas.
She felt that she couldn't confide in her friends, couldn't confide in her family about the problems that she was facing, the isolation which she felt, her suspicions about her husband's friendship with Camilla Parker Bowles, and this brought her to the brink of despair, so much so that on, as I say in the book, on several occasions she attempted suicide. And I'll make it perfectly clear that these were not genuine attempts to kill herself, but they were desperate, desperate cries for help.
I think that the only thing that one can say is that it is an immense relief that this happened during daylight and mid-morning when there were a lot of people around. Had this happened at night, in the place that it happened, I think we would have lost a great deal more.
1992 is not a year on which I shall look back with undiluted pleasure. In the words of one of my more sympathetic correspondents, it has turned out to be an annus horribilis.
It is announced from Buckingham Palace that, with regret, the Prince and Princess of Wales have decided to separate. Their Royal Highnesses have no plans to divorce, and their constitutional positions are unaffected. This decision has been reached amicably, and they will both continue to participate fully in the upbringing of their children. Their Royal Highnesses will continue to carry out full and separate programmes of public engagements and will from time to time attend family occasions and national events together. The Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh, though saddened, understand and sympathise with the difficulties that have led to this decision. Her Majesty and His Royal Highness particularly hope that the intrusions into the privacy of the Prince and Princess may now cease.
In 1993, Mr. Major had his own share of misfortune. His popularity in a Gallup poll was the lowest for any Prime Minister since polling began in Britain in the late 1930s. Recession, scandal, divisions over Europe all came together to make his premiership vulnerable. Sacking Norman Lamont as Chancellor of the Exchequer pleased the right of his party, but Mr. Lamont had a sharp sting in his voice during a bitter speech to the House of Commons.
There is something wrong with the way we make our decisions. The government listens too much to the pollsters and the party managers. There is too much short-termism, too much reacting to events, not enough shaping of events. We give the impression of being in office, but not in power. We are politicians as well as policy makers, but we are also the trustees of the nation. And I believe that in politics, you should decide what is right and then decide the presentation, not the other way around. Unless this approach is changed, the government will not survive and will not deserve to survive.
We finish where we started, the Middle East. 20 years after the Yom Kippur War, a new era is opening there. Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization signed an historic treaty recognizing each other's right to exist. The Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin said despite the obstacles to peace, he remained optimistic.
It's an historic moment that hopefully will bring about end to 100 years of bloodshed, misery between the Palestinians and Jews, between Palestinians and Israel.
What you've been listening to has been 20 years of LBC reporting. I'm Douglas Cameron, and it's been my privilege to have brought you the news during an exciting and historic period of broadcasting. This program was researched and produced by Charlie Rose and Tim Crook, and they join me in paying tribute not only to the reporters whose voices you've heard, but also to the producers, writers, and technicians behind the scenes. Finally, our sincere thanks to the people of the world who've spoken to LBC since 1973, and to the people of London who've listened.